The fourth case this morning is number 033611, Donald Schimmer against Jaguar Cars Incorporated. Mr. Crowe.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is now the fourth time I've been in front of this court on the issue of jurisdiction in one of these Magnus DeMoss cases. All three of the predecessor cases have been remanded for that reason, and I stand before you today to explain that this case is no different from any three of those and is actually a lot clearer of a line, I believe, in that issue.
Have we, in any of the earlier cases, definitively decided the question when, indeed, there is a cause of action stated for rescission of the contract?
All of the complaints were the same with respect to the Magnus DeMoss allegations. The only difference in this case is there was a count for the Illinois New Vehicle Buyer Protection Act, which is commonly referred to as the Illinois Lemon Law. So with any additional or different remedy that case or that count would give that was ultimately dismissed, would change the course of the way I guess you could look at jurisdiction. But in this case, like I just said, that count was dismissed based by this court in December of 2003 based on the reading that one of the definitions of the Illinois Lemon Law, which is the second issue in our brief, is that the warranty itself must be a warranty of quality or future performance, not a remedial warranty such as all the ones that are given from modern day car manufacturers. So with the issue of jurisdiction, what we have, and it's no different from the case of Masana, which is the second one I argued.
I need to talk to you about that.
Okay.
Because, Mr. Crone, Masana is an unpublished order, and it doesn't have presidential value, and it shouldn't be cited under Circuit Rule 53.
Well, there were two orders in Masana.
Both are.
Okay, I apologize, Your Honor,
yeah.
if we have done that, I'm very aware of that rule and apologize. To that end, I will leave that from my argument. I think I can rely on Leshik and Diamond, which was just recently decided. Judge Easterbrook and Leshik, Gardinsky Leshik, taught me the lesson that when you do any calculation formula, no matter if it's ours that's obviously beneficial to what we want to be a remand here, or Ford's, which he wants the number to be higher, any calculation you do is ultimately what Easterbrook taught us was that you have to look at the residual value of the car. You just can't take the formula and say, here is the number being paid out by the defendant. You then have to look at the property that they are getting back and the potential value of that.
Would that depend on the cause of action stated, though? I mean, that might be true in some causes of action under some state law, but not under others. Can that be cited as a universal proposition?
Well, I didn't think so until that became the law, and I actually argued against
it. Did he have to take that position in order to decide that case? Or is that just dicta?
Well, I don't believe it was dicta. The ruling was that there was no jurisdiction to begin with. How he got to that ruling is he provided a formula. And he did provide some dicta. I remember one sentence was, at best case, this case is worth $5,000. I'm not standing before you to say that should be the measure of damages. It's just the underlying point, I think, that led the court, the panel, to that decision, which was, you can't look at the formulas in a vacuum and how they play out just on paper without taking the very practical effect of considering the amount of the property they get back.
You know, Mr. Crone, the record here doesn't tell us our number, right? Because at most, Mr. Schimmer would be entitled to the purchase price minus the wear and tear he put on the car for 2 years.
Correct.
Could the wear and tear be more than $19,153.
Right. She just provided a perfect illustration to which I should have thought of to the answer to your question. That's what I'm saying. If you take the $69,000, and let's just say in Ford's defense there was no subtractions whatsoever. Let's say through whatever formula you use, he was to get and receive the full $69,000. What the courts have said in Diamond and Gardinsky-Leszczyk is, okay, now he's getting the $69,000, we're getting the car. How much is the value of that car? It has to be, you have to put some attributable value in a practical application of jurisdiction to that property that they're getting back. So even if they got the full $69,000 and they got the car, this Jaguar with 5,000 miles on it back, what Ford would have to stand up here and say is that the residual value of that car was worth less than $19,000 on a $70,000 car. And it's just that simple. Even if you weigh all the formulas in their direction, which is what I was trying to say to Your Honor, you know, even if forgetting Judge Easterbrook's specific formula, any formula that you take, once the law is clear through Gardinsky, Leszczyk, and Diamond that you have to look at some residual value, and if you do that, all you have to have here is 19 and change, which takes you under the 50. And that is absurd, to think that on a $70,000 car with $5,000 market, even at an auction branded a lemon or whatever tag you want to put on it, that it's not going to reap at least, you know, 25% to 30%, I think we're somewhere in there, of its purchase price. And don't forget, too, the $69,000 was the base price of the car. It was without taxes and all the extra fees included at the time of sale. So if I can take 1 minute, because I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, to get also into the dismissal, as I touched on earlier, of the Illinois Lemon Law counter, the New Vehicle Buyer Protection Act. I know I have a tough road this morning, and any time you come in here, or any appellate jurisdiction for that matter, with a public policy argument, it's a tough road ahead. However, I just wanted to impress upon the court the absurdity of the application of the Volcker decision in with respect to our state's lemon law, that it was, and I admit, written poorly because of that one definition, that it says it must have a warranty that's defined by the UCC, which we're left with future performance or quality of the goods. However, I think the court has the ability to say, well, every warranty these days is a warranty of only remedial measures, which is to repair or replace, you know, any defective parts. And therefore, this decision has basically abolished the Illinois Lemon Law, to which it set out to protect by its definition or its title, New Vehicle Buyer Protection Act. How can the application, the technical application of that one or two or three words written in there, abolish an entire statute which would leave in effect Illinois the only state that I am aware of without a state lemon law? And with that, I will reserve my couple minutes for rebuttal if the panel has no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crowell.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Ray.
Good morning. My name is Timothy Ray, and I represent the defendant appellee, Jaguar Cars.
Mr. Ray, could I just real quick ask you this? The Volcker opinion was revised on rehearing on the day you filed your brief.
Correct.
Did the revisions affect your argument in any way?
Not at all.
It is a very surprising opinion, isn't it? I mean, to me it is. I mean, that repair and replace warranties aren't treated as express warranties.
Well, that's what the Act says, and that's how the case law has interpreted the Act. As to what Mr. Crone was saying about the Illinois New Vehicle Lemon Law, I think that its application is how it was intended to be. When you look at what you stated in the Volcker opinion, what this court stated in the Volcker opinion, I think that was the right ruling. That is consistent with how Illinois courts have interpreted. That is consistent with Cosman. That is consistent with how Judge Leinenweber interpreted the Act. What I'd like to direct the court to do is to not focus so much on Leszczyk. Leszczyk, a lot of what Leszczyk involved was dicta, as Your Honor pointed out. And I do not think that it should have any widespread application in these types of cases. When you look at what the language of the Act states, The language of the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act states the following in section 2310D1. That section talks about civil action by a consumer for damages, jurisdiction, recovery of costs and expenses, and cognizable claims. Subject to subsections A, 3, and E, a consumer who is damaged by a failure of a supplier, warranty, or service contractor to comply with any obligation under this title or under a written warranty, implied warranty, or service contract may bring suit for damages and other legal and equitable relief. That is what we need to focus on here today, what the language of the Act says, and give meaning to may bring suit for damages and other legal equitable relief. That is essentially what Mr. Schirmer sought to avail himself in this particular case. He didn't seek to cover. Nowhere in his complaint did he indicate that he's only looking to get a certain amount back. His actions did not indicate that, neither did his pleadings.
Yeah, but we need to talk about, you know, well, look, even on the revocation claim, Mr. Schirmer is not entitled to the entire amount he paid because he used the car for 2 years, right?
We're assuming, though, that he's only entitled to what, that the only amount of damages that he can get is some diminished value relative to what the car presently is worth versus what he paid in its defective condition for the vehicle.
Wait, look, shouldn't we subtract the value of 2 years of use from the purchase price?
No.
Why?
You should not, Your Honor. Because I'm not certain, as we sit here today, if that is what Mr. Schirmer was looking for. That is what the court would like to do as a feasible...
Who cares what he's looking for if that's the correct thing to do under the law?
Because the Act...
He may decide that Engelbert Humperdinck rode in the car and it's worth, you know, twice as much.
The Act does not limit him to only deriving damages from that particular method, and that's what I'm getting at. The Act doesn't say that we have to deduct 2 years' worth of use for him to, for his beneficial use to come up with damages. The Act says you should look to state law. Then if we look to state law, we look to the Uniform Commercial Code. And if we look to the Uniform Commercial Code, the Uniform Commercial Code does not limit his damages. That is not the only way that he can derive the damages in these types of cases.
Is there any authority in Illinois for a rescission remedy that would be, where the rescission would not be mitigated by previous use of the vehicle?
There are cases, Your Honor, that speak to the issue of, it depends more specifically on the facts of the case. And there are cases where courts have taken into consideration in commercial settings, true commercial settings, widgets, machines, things of that nature, the beneficial use of an item. But in car cases particularly, no. I'm not aware of any that says, look, you have to deduct from the equation the beneficial use that Mr. Schirmer or a plaintiff got for the vehicle in coming up with a figure.
Are there cases that support your view that you need not deduct beneficial use from the contract price of the vehicle?
If you are trying to determine what the present value is and you are factoring in use, options on the vehicle, things of that nature, if that is all that you're seeking, you're trying to figure out what the present value is to get to what a diminished value is, yes, you would then look at those.
But that wasn't my question.
I'm sorry, Judge.
My question was whether or not there are cases supporting your view that there is a rescission remedy where you do not take into consideration beneficial use.
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. What I'm mostly, my argument is relegated to the clear language of the Act, which allows for various remedies, legal and other equitable relief. It also relies on the Uniform Commercial Code, and I think that is where.
But that just sounds to me then like a kind of in abstracto argument. I mean, the courts have never interpreted the Act. In conformity to that view, is that correct?
Right. If I understand your question correctly, what I'm essentially saying is that when you take into account revocation or rescission, you have to look at what the person is actually seeking to undo, and what they're looking to revoke is the contract. They're not looking to revoke the warranty. The terms of the contract have already been defined. We know, looking at the contract, that the vehicle was worth $69,000 and some odd dollars. So
years ago.
Pardon me?
2 years ago.
Yes, Your Honor.
So my point is there any basis for saying that one could recover the entire $69,000 as a matter of substantive Illinois law?
Is there any basis for saying that one could recover that? To be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know what in the realm of these types of cases is recoverable. The jury could have determined that the case was worth, that he should have gotten a complete refund.
Your argument is you were supposed to decide jurisdiction from the face of the complaint.
Correct.
But when you look at the face of the complaint, you look at non-frivolous claims. And you
Correct.
Say that a claim for rescission for the full contract value of the car is a non-frivolous claim. And so my question
Correct.
To you is, well, do you have any case law that takes that position?
In terms of it being a non-frivolous claim, no.
Yeah.
This issue has not been decided. This is an issue that is before the court for the very first time, and I think you went to that exact point. When you asked Mr. Crone, have we ever decided this issue before in the other cases where we have denied jurisdiction or where we have found that jurisdiction did not exist? All of the cases that you looked at, Diamond, Luschuk, and Volker, and Your Honor mentioned Masana, in those particular cases, there was no... Nothing was given to me or to the legal community to explain why in those cases the court did not consider revocation of acceptance in its analysis of those opinions. In none of those cases did the word revocation even come up. So there was no thought given by this court as to what effect having a count like that would have in the case.
I may be really dense, but I cannot understand how, even on a revocation claim, he can't be entitled to the entire amount he paid because he has used this car for 2 years.
Well, that may be the case, Your Honor, but I don't think that you do have to look at substantial impairment. When you talk about revocation, you do have to look at substantial impairment. But the fact of the matter is that what this court is trying to do, Luschuk is not the case to determine whether or not Mr. Schimmer's vehicle was substantially impaired. When you look at the analysis that the court engaged in Luschuk, that's a cover case. If the plaintiff does not avail himself to cover damages, is he only limited to that, or is he only limited to that? No. And no case law...
How would you instruct a jury on how to determine damages in this case, under your view?
I would say you look at what the plaintiff, the pecuniary interest of what the plaintiff is actually seeking to have done. What he's actually seeking to have done or undone is the contract. What is the value of the contract? The value of the contract is $69,000. That is what we're disputing. He's not seeking to have undone or have revoked the warranty. He's seeking to have undone the entire value of the contract. That is what we have to look at, the contract itself.
And his use of that car, this is great. His use of that car wouldn't come into it at all. He could use the car, he could trash the car, he could do anything to the car, and he still could have the $69,000?
That is essentially what their complaint is asking for. If you look at the pleadings that they filed, that is essentially what they're asking for. They're not asking to... At no time during this case did Mr. Schimmer file an affidavit, which I think the court has pointed out in other cases you can do to say that you're not going to be seeking greater than $50,000. At no time during the course of this case, subject to Rule 11 sanctions, Mr. Schimmer filed a pretrial packet stating what his damages are and that they were in excess of $50,000, irrespective of the use. So I think what the court is grappling with is how do we come up with an amount that allows either this case for the court to find jurisdiction or to remand it to state court. And Luschuk is not the case. This should not be a one-size-fits-all type of approach. And a lot of what Luschuk was saying was dicta. Now, I'm not saying that Luschuk may not be applicable, but it's only applicable in cover-type cases. And in no way did Mr. Schimmer agree to limit his damages to cover. I'm talking about the specific fact of this case.
And it looks like my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. You have 2 minutes, Mr. Crone.
Thank you, Your Honor. We filed the case in Law Division for $30,000. I agree with you, Justice Rovner. That would be...
Oh, it's only Judge, but thank you.
Judge Rovner, that would be the greatest situation ever. No, we didn't file it for that amount. We didn't ask for that amount. We filed it in state court for $30,000. I'm not going to bring up Masana's case law, but I will tell you, in that case, just as a result at a trial level...
You can't tell us anything about it.
Excuse me, you say you filed it for $30,000, you set $30,000 in your complaint?
Correct. As our jurisdictional limit in Law Division in Cook County.
This case.
They remanded it. We did not file it in federal court. I mean, removed it, I'm sorry.
In Law Division, you have to set an amount? My understanding with Illinois law, you didn't normally...
I'm sorry. We filed a 222 affidavit to that amount, which was attached to the complaint. You're right. It wasn't a true addendum like Your Honor is indicating. But to that end, I just will tell you that what we asked for is of no matter, like this court has pointed out, it all depends on at the time of filing what the possible damages are. And I was just trying to make it as simple as, even though I agree with the court, of course you get an offset for the use. Of course there are things that you subtract out. However, even if you didn't do that in this case, because it is only $69,000, and you do consider the underlying way that both the Diamond Court and the Gardinsky-Leshy Court got to where they were going, which is the amount of the property that you get back.
I take it the record won't tell us what the blue book would say.
Well, it wasn't our burden, and again, we filed it in the state court. You know, that was theirs to carry, and still is today. And of course we didn't put those numbers because we would allege that it really isn't worth the blue book value. But again, and courts in both Diamond and Gardinsky-Leshy said, as a practical matter, we have to give it some value.
So if, just so I don't die tonight wondering, what is the blue book value?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
I truly don't.
I'm
going to
die tonight?
But it's easily ascertainable on the Internet in a couple
on
minutes.
On the Internet, right. Okay.
Right, KBV.com. You can get a Kelly Blue Book. And if I could have 30 seconds on Volcker, I would just beg this court not to let this issue die here with a rubber stamp on Volcker. I just beg the court to consider.
I think we have the point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case. The case will be taken under advisement.